Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The brothers Anderson are. This is Eric, he's the oldest one. The producer who makes it fun, gotta give him the credit. He's good with the edits. He's been the driving force since they begun. Next we got brother Jay. He just the movies that they play. The sip in the middle, Jay is gonna be a little more critical, analytical when he communicates. And lastly we got Drew, the finally family member of this group. He decides if the movie's worth it. Right kind of guy, that's for certain. Three chatty brothers with a family base. Need an excuse to talk away. Dichotomy of personalities. All you really need to do is press play. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies till they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open to that case. We got Eric, Drew, and brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way.
Hey. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is brother Jay.
This is Drew.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 1999 HBO project RKO 281, directed by Benjamin Ross.
Yeah, we are.
Now, it's funny because it turns out the Citizen Kane episode, I mean, it's good that only two of us really liked it and Drew didn't, because that gives us that contrast that makes the show more interesting. But I guess it could have been an opportunity to shove this movie in as a twofer.
Probably would have been a better idea.
Yeah, but this is a good enough movie that I think you should watch it on your own, even if you have no intention of watching Citizen Kane.
Except that I think our episode has pushed our mother into thinking about seriously rewatching it.
Good, good.
So
rewatching Citizen Kane.
Yeah, because her opinion was that, and of course I'm going to say I don't want to put words in her mouth, but then again I'm going to turn around and exactly put words in her mouth. So she basically said she watched it and just hated it, and I was like, well, I think if you went back, you would get a different angle out of it. You might appreciate it differently. You might still hate it, but I know that as an adult, I've got a lot different things out of the movie than I did when I watched it when I was a youth.
Well, and she might watch it now under the lens of our little family history we sort of stumbled upon a funny part of during that episode. There was just an offhanded comment that we bleeped, but I had to leave it in because your guys' reaction was pretty great.
Mm-hmm. I had totally forgotten about that comment, and I laughed just as hard when I was listening to the episode as when you said it.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that I couldn't not leave it in, because, and then I had to instantly text mom and ask a couple of questions, and she's like, why? I'm like, I just want to know how, you know, whether this is going to be offensive or not. But it turns out, I don't think I...
Oh, please. Oh, is this going to be offensive? Like, that has ever stopped you.
Oh, it has. I've unsuccessfully bleeped a lot of stuff. I've, with some success, bleeped a lot of stuff. Anyway, okay, so, RKO 281. Drew, you had mentioned on our Citizen Kane episode... Mm-hmm. That you think this is a more enjoyable movie than watching Citizen Kane.
Yes.
So bring us in. First time, this time.
I don't even remember the first time I watched it, but I watched it because it was featured on an At the Movies episode where they talked about it and they recommended it. And I had seen Citizen Kane when I was a little kid, so I kind of knew... I knew the movie a little bit, and I'm always kind of interested in the making of kind of stories. So I found this movie, sought it out, watched it, and thought it was really quite enjoyable. There's a lot of really good people in it, a lot of really good performances. I don't know how much of this movie is actually true. Watching it again as a much older person, I can kind of see the seams a little bit. It definitely seems heavily dramatized, but in a fun way. It's got a really young Liev Schreiber. This might be the first thing I ever saw him in. And Malkovich doing his Malkovich thing. And James Cromwell giving a performance that makes you empathetic towards someone who should be extremely unlikable.
His portrayal of Hearst?
Yes. Just the way he looks at people makes you feel bad for him. So, yeah, this isn't a great this isn't a great masterpiece of a movie, but it's perfectly fine. It's a good movie to just kind of watch and not have to think about too hard. It's not groundbreaking, but I think it's fun and it's interesting and it's not too long and it moves along quickly. Everything you want.
Brother Jay, first time this time.
So I had purchased a collector's edition multiple DVD disc set of Citizen Kane, and it was very smartly advertised at the store that I bought it at, adjacent to RKO 281. And I looked at it and I thought, well, that's fascinating. I gotta watch that. And of course, at the time, I'd only recognized Melanie Griffith really out of it. And that was not a selling point, but regardless, I decided to bring it home and watch Citizen Kane and then watched it, RKO 281. And I felt it was a pretty exhilarating ride because it gave a lot of depth to something that was not necessarily understood, the process of the movie and the thought process of Orson Welles and the tension that was created. And again, dramatized, how much of it was real, how much of it was embellished, who knows? But it at least got me thinking about the kind of things that would have transpired that could have happened. Because none of what they were portraying was really all that far out of the realm of possibility. You know, how probable, how possible. I mean, you can debate those back and forth, but I recalled really enjoying the movie. Also, because I'm a huge Roy Scheider fan,
His face in this movie. His face looks like it. They just like carved it off of Mount Rushmore and put it on a body.
I was thinking Chief Woodenhead from Creepshow 2.
Yeah, he's great.
So, and I think everybody in this movie gave a solid performance. I think nobody was really phoning it in. It was like they were all serious actors.
So it was directed by Benjamin Ross, but do you know who produced it?
Mm-mm.
Drew?
Nope. Nope.
Jason, why don't you look it up?
One moment, please.
Drum roll, please.
And this was a weird time for HBO, right? I mean, it was premium cable, but it wasn't quite yet prestige TV. So it's certainly not like a theatrical silver screen movie, but it's not quite down to the level of what you would think of as a TV movie either.
Oh, yeah.
It's somewhere in between.
There's money in this movie.
Yeah. But not a ton of money.
Well, it looked big. It looked like they spent some money.
Okay, so there are five co-producers listed. Are you talking about Mr. Ridley Scott?
And his brother.
Oh, Tony Scott.
Yeah.
Oh.
It was Scott Free production, right?
And they had, you know, again, I get a sense that, you know, some producers just write checks and other producers have a lot more influence. And I'm guessing the Scott brothers had influence in this movie.
Wasn't Ridley Scott going to direct this with a different cast?
Oh, there was weird cast. I think I read someplace in the trivia that there was like some weird casting choices, right?
Let me go look. Let's dive like right into the crazy.
Something in the Burt Reynolds, Tom Selleck kind of thing. Tom Cruise sort of. I'm not sure.
Trivia. This was originally planned to be a theatrical film. The original cast was going to consist of Edward Norton as Orson Welles, Marlon Brando as William Randolph Hearst, Madonna as Marion Davies.
Oh, that's terrible.
Dustin Hoffman as Menkowitz, Meryl Streep as Luella Parsons, and then Ridley Scott was slated to direct, but the studio passed on the original film because of the projected $40 million budget. Scott dropped out as director. Brando and Hoffman also dropped out. Gene Hackman was considered to replace Brando, and Al Pacino was considered to replace Hoffman. Eventually, the project was scaled down to a television movie, and the entire cast was replaced.
Gene Hackman would have been a great Hearst. Not quite big enough, though.
But Edward Norton would not be a good Wells.
No, he might think he is Orson Welles, well, right? In real
yeah,
life?
Maybe, yeah.
Death to Smoochie.
But, which I still haven't seen.
Oh, you gotta see it.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so that cast, I mean, that would have been like an Oscar bait kind of movie with the potential to really suck. But this cast is like right off of like Steppenwolf or Groundlings or one of the, I guess Groundlings is a comedy thing, but you know, one, this is like, this is again like Steppenwolf theater actor level, right? Like that's where Malkovich is from. But I mean, Roy Scheider was pretty much the only name guy in this movie, right? I mean, Melanie Griffith.
Well, Malkovich.
Yeah, okay. But even then, Malkovich wasn't. Was Malkovich in 99?
Well, let's take a look.
Because when was In Line of Fire?
That was like 96 or something.
Okay, yeah. So maybe Malkovich was already getting to be Malkovich.
Oh, dear. Because when was 7?
He wasn't in 7.
Yeah, I don't know. He's not 7. You're thinking...
Oh, who am I thinking of? Oh, Kevin Spacey.
Yeah. I think Kevin Spacey might think he is John Malkovich.
So, no, being John Malkovich was before RKO 281, as was Rounders was before that. Con Air was before that.
All right, so Malkovich was Malkovich. I'm sorry.
Mary Riley. In the Line of Fire was 93.
Oh, okay. Oh,
Jennifer 8.
That's an Andy Garcia movie, right?
I think so. We saw that in the theater.
Yeah.
Oh, was it Madeline Stowe? Oh.
No.
Uma Thurman and Lance Henriksen.
No Madeline Stowe? I'm thinking of something else then.
Yeah.
Jennifer Jason Leigh?
No.
Hmm.
Uma Thurman, Kathy Baker.
Is Andy Garcia in it?
Yeah.
Okay. Like, am I thinking of just a total wrong movie?
Wow. So sorry. I was Malkoviching it up.
Yeah. No, Malkovich is great. Let me tell you.
No, I like John Malkovich very much.
I thought the performances in this were actually, except for Melanie Griffith, which I think we had this discussion during Pacific Heights, the first time I saw her in this movie, the first couple scenes she was in, I had that same feeling like, oh, she's not a good actor. And then by the end of it, I'm like, oh, she kind of pulled it off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's a surprising actor. But Liev Schreiber's great. I can't think of anything. You know, we know him, of course, from Mixed Nuts, Twilight, The Sum of All Fears, The Manchurian Candidate 2004, and Salt.
I forgot about Twilight. He was great in Twilight.
Yeah, that's the young Liev Schreiber.
He does smarmy very well.
Yeah, well, and it's funny because he actually pulls off the Orson Welles face. Because that's why I thought, for some reason, I thought it was Oliver Platt who played Orson Welles.
Oh, that would have been amazing.
Well, he's just got that kind of, he's a little bit, like, Liev Schreiber is built like young Orson Welles.
You don't like Mr. Platt?
I do, but I don't think he's very good in super serious roles.
Huh.
Have you ever, did you watch The West Wing at all?
No.
How about, do you remember Flatliners?
Oh, yeah.
Of course, that wasn't exactly super serious.
That was not.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was kind of the goofy one in that group, right?
Yeah, I think so. We're gonna have to AB the new Flatliners and the old Flatliners.
There's a new one?
Yeah, there's the new one with Ellen Page and I can't remember who else is in it.
Kiefer Sutherland.
Is then he in both or was he not in the first one?
He was in the first one.
Yeah, okay. He was in the right. First one.
That's, yeah, isn't that's where
he met Julia Roberts? Julia
Roberts, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I think the new one was maybe a secret sequel.
Ah, okay. Well,
not a remake.
We'll have to check it out. Remind me, library talk.
The library.
I've fallen in love. I've gone to the library like twice a week or more since I discovered it.
Scandal.
I'm actually going to run out of movies, but they're sending them from all over the state, which I love. Anyway, so it's 1940. And Orson Welles, played by Liev Schreiber, is with RKO studio head George Schaefer, played by Roy Scheider from Jaws in 2010. And by the way, Roy Scheider actually does a good job, too. I forget how he's a legitimate actor as well. He has some gravity.
Yeah, he was great.
And then he and screenwriter Herman Mankiewicz, John Malkovich, who we know from Rounders and being John Malkovich, They're struggling to make what is considered the greatest American film of all time, Citizen Kane. And they give us a scene of Wells and Mankiewicz attending a party at Hearst Castle where they meet the hypocritical and tyrannical William Randolph Hearst, played by James Cromwell, who we know from Murder by Death, Eraser, The Sum of All Fears, iRobot, and W.
And Babe.
Well, and Babe. We haven't talked about Babe, though, on the podcast. But someday that'll do.
Now, I see what you did there.
Later, I will give you a list of things that are probably not correct about this movie. But the idea is this party at the Hearst Castle gives the inspiration for Orson Welles' next big project. And that's going to be, it was just called The American, right? Was the original, his original idea. And it was, you know, sort of a...
something very banal like that.
And it was a story about a great man or blah, blah, blah. So... in this portrayal, Mankiewicz knows that this is, he knows that Hearst is not someone to be dealing with. Mankiewicz at this point is older and a drunk and, you know, his glory days are behind him. And I thought, again, I thought Mankiewicz's performance is pretty great. And there's a scene at the party or after the party where Mankiewicz is trying to tell Wells that no, you can't do this because Hearst will bury you.
I've got it. I know what we're going to do. Imagine a man who shaped his time. A titanic figure of limitless ambition. A man with an empire at his feet, controlling the perceptions of everyone beneath him. A modern feudal lord. The great American biography, A Journey into the Heart of the Beast.
Oh, no.
Don't you see it? He spent a lifetime making entertainment out of other people's lives, and now we turn the tables on him. It's perfect.
It's perfectly suicidal.
How long have I been looking for the answer when all this time it's been right here under my nose, every day in the newspapers, on the radio, waiting for us in that ridiculous castle,
Orson,
waiting
stop,
to
stop, stop.
I've talked to Arnie. He says it's all right. He says he's a public figure who sought out that publicity so legally he can't...
Listen to me, you child. He doesn't worry about legalities. Do you know why? Because he has more power than you could even begin to imagine.
All the more reason to do it!
Because he insulted you at a dinner party?
Because he's a hypocrite. Because he's a political turncoat. He claims to care about the common man when nothing could be further from the truth.
Well, he's a journalist. He owns Hollywood. We're the shit on his shoes. You better go back to Broadway, kiddo.
Expected more from you, Mike.
Yeah, me too, but I got used to it.
Just the phrase, I expected more from you. I was like, yeah, me too. I love it.
Touche.
I love Malkovich's Mank. I love the fact that Mank has a couple of different, has like a little turn or a couple different facets to his character. And Wells has Wells is a good guy, but he's also not a good guy. And Hearst is a bad guy, but he also is sympathetic. And, you know, Scheider's character, Schaefer, is also sympathetic, but kind of caught between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, there's no villain in this movie.
Not really.
You could argue that Orson Welles is the villain, but he has so much charisma that he's your protagonist anyway.
Yeah. And, you know, and again, Hearst is the antagonist. He really is something of a villain. Mm-hmm. But again, he's aggrieved, and it's a legitimate beef he has.
Yeah.
He just has the power to take care of himself.
Yeah, it's hard to feel sympathy for somebody who has that much wealth and can wield that much power and is used to getting everything he wants. But the way Cromwell plays him, just so kind of beaten down and brokenhearted despite having it all, really makes you feel for him, even though you shouldn't.
Well, and I think actually his performance against Melanie Griffith as Marion Davies is actually pretty great, because she starts off as, again, like a dumb blonde. Mm-hmm. But then she calls him out on all his shit. And, you know, he doesn't agree with her necessarily, but it makes him both more sympathetic and kind of pathetic.
Yeah, I don't think I had a more black and white perspective when I watched this, 20 years ago? But watching it now, you know, I'm not I'm not convinced that what he did to Orson Welles was so bad to deserve what Welles did to him by humiliating him with this movie.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, is the whole premise of this movie...
It was completely disproportionate.
Yeah, except that the idea that... I mean, isn't there a more graceful way out of it? Like, if Hearst...
For who?
If Hearst hadn't made such a big deal out of it...
Out of the movie?
Yeah, if he was more of a... Like, oh, Welles, fuck that guy. But wasn't, like, didn't try to bury him. While he himself was going through all these other issues.
At that point, yeah, he's going too far. And he's lost the moral high ground. But in the beginning, the part that, you know, makes him a target of Welles in the first place, it doesn't seem all that bad. You know, Welles talks to Mankiewicz about what a bad guy Hearst is because he's done all these things and he wields his power inappropriately. But you don't ever see any of that on the screen. The only interaction you see with Hearst and Welles on the screen isn't really bad enough to justify Welles using all the resources he has at his disposal to try and humiliate him in a very personal way.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that it seems like it became very personal and all over this slight at dinner where mm-hmm. Welles is trying to tell like a raconteur story and Hearst is very dismissive and judgmental about it. So Welles is got his feelings hurt.
And he reacts the way you would expect a 24-year-old to react.
Yes.
Asshole.
Of course. Yeah. But again, not everybody is William Randolph Hearst who can actually crush you by some pretty diabolical means.
Yes.
Which is why we enter, we don't enter. The character enters, which is where we get Hedda Hopper, played by Fiona Shaw. And she is, of course, why don't I have her in my notes either? Luella Parsons, right, is the Hearst paper gossip columnist or whatever. She's the one that was present the night that Thomas Ince was shot and killed on the Hearst boat. Part of the Cat's Meow story. The whole idea is that Luella Parsons is on, Luella Parsons is on Hearst's payroll because basically, she's a gossip columnist and she's widely read or whatever, but B, she's been sworn to secrecy, so therefore she's got a job for life. But her arch rival is Hedda Hopper, played by Fiona Shaw in this. She is also a ruthless gossip columnist, and she wants to get in good with the old man. So she gets into an advanced screening of the movie and instantly goes and blabs, which it gives her a little bit of credit with the man, and also her rival gets taken down a peg at the same time. So she's a conniving person, too, in this. So Hearst finds out and, you know, sends both of them out to get more material. And so he's got, apparently, much like a J. Edgar Hoover character, they apparently collect files on people to use against them when necessary. So that's why when his plan is to have all of the studio heads together a fund.
We all have blackmail files on our enemies, right?
I don't have any enemies. I don't think I do. So that's the deal. Yeah. Seems like a lot of work. Oh, by the way, note to self, don't cross Drew. He's got a file on me.
Oh, I have a little black book that I write names in for people to be taken care of at the proper time.
Oh, dear God. You guys are amazing. By the way, are you guys following Brexit?
Yes.
I am so excited about Brexit. So
it makes me feel so much better about the state of affairs in our dumpster fire of a country.
It does. So Boris Johnson, his first appearance at Parliament, he now has a 100% voted down rating as a prime minister, and he may never get a law passed through there. But his brother actually quit the party quit the Conservative Party because of Brexit. So, of course, the joke is, here's a politician who quits the office to spend less time with his family. But it's so
well. Fun. Also, you saw that Churchill's grandson got kicked out.
Well, yeah, all those people voted against Johnson, and therefore against the Tories, and of course, who's Dominic Cummings, who is the Steve Bannon of the Johnson administration, basically told Johnson, "Oh yeah, kick them out of the party, or take the whip away from them," is how they refer to it.
Yeah. So they're no longer able to even run for election in their own party.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. They're still ministers of parliament, but they no longer are part of the party. So they're calling it like a purge. So it's like a purge and a coup and everything is going on. And it certainly makes our president, who just takes a Sharpie to weather maps, look a lot more tame.
Yes, except the Sharpie to weather map is a federal crime.
Presidents can't commit federal crimes. Haven't you been reading?
Fucking A.
Anyway, what's funny is
with the British Parliament, and then what they turned around and did, and like big old middle finger to Boris Johnson, like, fine, you want to do that? You want to have your little temper tantrum? We're going to put the referendum in and pass a law that you can't do what you were going to try and do.
Oh, it's so diabolical that he, like the Steve Bannon guy, the Dominic Cummings, I think is his name. The whole idea was they prorogate parliament so that they stop parliament. So they have a very small window to vote on things so they can shove through what they want. And, if they lost the ability to just go ahead, like the parliament went and, voted for, that they had to, they were not allowed to do a no deal Brexit. So the idea was, okay, then they'll just call an election. They'll call an election. Johnson's such a charismatic figure that, and you know, a populist, that he'll actually get a bigger majority out of the election. And by the time the election's over, there won't be any time to do anything either. And he'll go to Brussels and they'll crash out of Brexit and problem solved. But now they have basically prevented him from calling an election.
So
even though the Labour Party has been suggesting they call an election for a long time, now that Boris Johnson is like, okay, you want an election? Let's have an election. They're like, nope, we'll call for an election after this law goes forth that we can't go have a no deal Brexit.
Yeah. So it's exactly 180 degrees of where he was trying to go.
Yeah. And then Jacob Jacob something Moss, he actually went because they put together Operation Yellowhammer. It's the report on what happens with a no-deal Brexit. And part of that report, this doctor was tasked to say what would happen. And he's like, well, it's going to be harder for you to get neurological drugs and some other like anti-seizure drugs and stuff because of with no deal, there's harder to get stuff. And so Jacob Rees-Mogg, I think that's his name, went on the floor of Parliament and said, yeah, this guy is as irresponsible as the doctor who linked autism to vaccinations. Like, called him that doctor's name. And so everybody's all up in arms about how, oh yeah, you're a monster. So he had to apologize for it. Boris Johnson had a speech today that I watched live. I love this. Where he went to a police training academy and basically gave like a campaign speech using police cadets as props.
I tried to get them to chant with him.
Yeah, and he speaks off the cuff, much like our president, where he shows up. He showed up an hour late in the heat. One of them that was a lady was standing behind him fainted because of the heat. They have stop and search or whatever is a thing over there. You know, much like we have over here, but you know, where we have the Miranda warning that has to be given to people, there's a warning that they have to give to people. And he tried to kind of mumble his way through it, but got it wrong.
Their Miranda is very different than ours, however.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. No, it is. Yep.
If you fail to speak, it may be used against you.
Exactly. Anyway, it's sorry. I know it's a big tangent, but
no, I listened to the Brexit cast.
Oh, yeah, I listen to the Romaniacs.
it is bonkers. I mean, I would have said if you would have told me this 5 years ago was going to happen, I would have called utter bullshit.
Well, the only nice thing about it from my perspective is that it gives me relief from just watching our news. Because again,
look, there's this giant dumpster fire over here.
Well, what's funny is, former Prime Minister John Major was, you know, very tactful in a very English way. He's like, you know, what with, doing this whole Brexit thing, this parliamentary shenanigans and this really un-English way that this is going about. In these times where the Americans are a little dysfunctional, hopefully temporarily, he says, and China is actually getting very aggressive economically, we can't afford to put ourselves at such a disadvantage. But anyway, so I love it. And I don't know enough about it. Like, I don't actually care about the characters involved. They're all cartoon characters to me.
It's just like, what is it? What was the big Sid Marty Krofft British cartoon?
Sid and Marty Krofft British?
Yeah, the British cartoon. We've discussed it before because it had like the giant like Margaret Thatcher Muppet doll.
Oh, that wasn't Sid and Marty Krofft. You're thinking of Spitting Image.
Yes, that's you're
yes,
right.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah,
I'm mixing my bad memories. So
yeah, Sid and Marty Krofft was HR Puffin stuff.
That's right.
Okay, so Drew, sorry.
No, thank you. That's very enlightening.
Oh, it's
well, it will be when the British start sending rafts over here and we still won't let them in. So
well, okay, so. So here's another thing.
And Kubo, as it turns out.
No. We'll get back to it. But just while I'm thinking about it, because again, I don't know enough about it to speak like.
Very American of you, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah. But I'm going to anyway. I'll speak about it even though I don't know enough about it. But
it must be the shirt.
Oh, Pensacola PJs. That's what I call these. Anyway, one of the things, you know, always a dig anyway. One of the things about them exiting from the European Union is that they will have to make their own trade agreements, including trade with America and or with the U.S. And of course, the U.S. is happy that because we can actually increase trade by like four times. Right. The problem is they don't want our chlorinated chicken. The EU has different food standards than America does. And one of the things that they don't allow is using chlorine on raw chicken to, I guess, kill germs or whatever. Because they don't want, you know, extra chemicals. They're also big on genetically modified stuff too. That's why this whole thing is a big pain in the ass with Ireland, because if Northern Ireland goats, which are UK goats, cross into Ireland and which is part of the EU, then they won't be able to be sold in the EU market. Because you can't guarantee that they're the same standards, because the UK would be able to give whatever antibiotics and whatever stuff that they want, because they won't be held to the EU regulations. That's why this whole backstop and stuff is a huge pain in the ass. What?
So I just want you to pull up the audio in the background so you can hear the crickets chirping from my backyard.
Okay. That's a note to get back to the movie. What you're saying?
It hit me as funny as I can hear the crickets, and it was all like full circle.
All right. Well, I will stop my rant.
Also, apparently, a wet woman's blouse is an insult. So
what?
One of the MPs called one of the other MPs a wet woman's blouse.
Also, pants. It's all very complicated.
Sorry, Brother Drew.
No, again, thank you for informing me. This is great.
I've been asking Dougie for to because he I guess I want to I can't I don't know exactly how to say it because I'm not officially a Kickstarter patron of this Andrew O'Neill movie, but Dougie literally gave Andrew O'Neill some money so that I can use the Kickstarter code to watch Andrew O'Neill's movie about the history of heavy metal. So, Dougie is like, hey, if you want, I can tell you about what it was like being in the theater while this was being recorded, because he's seen Andrew O'Neill a whole bunch of times. And he lives in Edinburgh, where there's the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, where you have a month of all these acts everywhere. And so I had questions for him about that, about, you know, what's it like to live in a city where there's this festival, and, you know, can you see a bunch of stuff, or is it cost prohibitive, and is it a big pain in the ass as a local because you got other people in town, blah blah blah. And so he's gonna answer those questions, but I'm trying not to ask him a bunch of Brexit questions. But it's hard, because of course in Scotland you've got a whole thing. I mean, Scotland narrowly voted to take themselves out of the UK. They nearly voted not to, but they would like another bite at that apple, since the UK is going to break out of the EU. They could actually want to stay in the EU, but be separate from the UK. So you have this whole Scottish party, which has been dominated by these other, like the Labour Party and the Tories and stuff. Now you've got this whole Scottish separate party or whatever that's going to take all the elections, the next election. The Labour Party and the Conservative Tory Party are both going to be like minority parties pretty soon. And you got these wackadoo parties, like, you know, I think there's actually a Brexit party, and then there's this Northern Irish party, UKIP or something called. And then there's.
Yeah, UKIP.
Yeah. And then there's the Liberal Dems, which are not the Labour Party.
Yeah, the Lib Dems, which always sounds so pejorative to me.
It does. It completely does, yeah.
Yeah.
But they may be, like, the moderates compared to... Because the Labour Party are, you know, straight-up socialists, pretty much.
And it turns out the robot did it.
The robot did it? I don't understand.
Sorry, it's a joke.
Joke for one.
Yeah. Somebody will laugh.
Wake up, Dougie! Okay, so back to... RKO 281.
Jesus God.
Hearst learns from Hedda Hopper, Fiona Shaw. He would view to private screening that Welles' film is just a thinly veiled and exceptionally unflattering biography of him. And so Hearst uses his immense power and influence to try to deny the release of the picture. And Hearst Mitrit. Hearst's. It's the Hearst part of it that's the problem. So William Randolph Hearst's side piece, Marion Davies, Melanie Griffith from Pacific Heights.
She's not really fair, though. She says primary piece.
Yeah, actually, it turns out. Yeah, but in real life, Hearst never got divorced. She was his mistress for 20-something years, probably. But, ever since she was 18 and he was 50. Which, by the way, as a man of 50, I cannot imagine. There's no way.
Well, except if you were a man of 50 that had that much wealth.
I don't know. Wouldn't you still have to talk to people? I don't want to talk to any 18-year-olds.
If you were... No, you wouldn't have...
I guess I wouldn't have to talk to somebody. Yeah, I guess you're right. If you just send it for that. But again, it's not like he...
You build a giant... like 1,000,000,000,000,000 acre estate to hide. What are you talking about? Talk to her.
So she endures the big embarrassment.
Besides, there's no way that they did a lot of talking.
Well, Marion Davies, as even Orson Welles said later, she really was the victim of the film.
Yes.
Because everything about Hearst was roughly, at least if not actually true, it was kind of on target. But it was kind of unfair, the Susan Alexander portrayal of Marion Davies, because it showed her a lot more pathetic than the real Marion Davies was. So, you know, of course, she gets the embarrassment. He, at this time, of course, his financial empire is kind of crumbling. So there's a nice scene. She takes a bunch of her jewelry and sells it and ends up presenting him a check for $1,000,000. So she's in it. She's pot committed. She's not going to take the money and run, like Susan Alexander did in the movie.
It was very sweet.
Yeah.
It's a lot of jewelry.
It is. And in real life, it turns out it was more than just jewelry. But again, we'll talk about the inconsistencies in just a moment. So then, of course, we have the whole thing at the end where we have Wells sort of sells out Mank and then has to go back and plead for his assistance. And they end up the film, because Wells is single-minded in his film. He puts Schaefer's career kind of in peril. And the film is finally released after, of course, we get the cabal of mostly Jewish film directors. Studio heads, not film directors, including one Walt Disney, who is played by a guy we know. Of course, I didn't write it down.
One moment.
He's from something that we just watched.
Such specificity. That's what our listeners have come to really rely on.
Again, this is one of the most famous movies of all time.
Not this movie. Citizen Kane.
Movie. Yes. But this is a movie about one of those famous movies. And it's a very enjoyable movie.
I forgot.
Walt Disney.
Roger Allam?
Yeah. Where is he from?
Oh, that guy. No idea.
Oh, he is from V for Vendetta. He's
Prothero.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh.
Yep. So, anywho. Oh,
I knew I recognized him. He has, by the way, he himself in a ton of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, by the way, you know, I think V for Vendetta is one of those films where it's one of those things we should watch annually.
I do watch it annually. Traditionally. On November 5th.
Guy Fox thing? Yeah.
Yeah, every year.
So, yeah.
It is a tradition.
Again, a holiday based on a guy who tried to blow up Parliament. Turns out England's been a funky country for a while. Hundreds of years.
Yeah.
They look at Trump and say, shit.
Hold my beer.
Yeah. So, it turns out, of course, Wells has his film, but that's all he has because everything kind of crumbles after that. And there's a nice scene at the end where Mank and Wells are sitting at a bar. And Mank says, hey, what's it like to peak at 26? He's like, no, I'm not Pete. Yeah, kid.
Yeah, well, then there was a scene before that when he told, was it Schaefer, Roy Scheider?
Yes.
Told him that he doesn't have anything else. So they can't bury the movie. He has nothing.
And he has all these big ideas. Like, I think in the real legend, he says, well, you know, if they want to buy it for $800,000 to burn it, why don't we buy it for $1 million and we'll show it forever in little tents and stuff? Because they don't. We're it's like, yeah, okay, that's great if you had $1 million, but you're a genius, Orson. You're not a rich guy. So, here are the inconsistencies from this movie and what is generally considered the truth. So it was really Mank who persuaded Orson Welles to do the Hearst story. Mank had already written the Hearst story. That was kind of the whole thing.
Yeah, that's touched on in this movie, right? Like, Orson Welles seems to have the idea, and he talks Mank into it, and then all of a sudden Mank has this giant file on Hearst.
Yeah, exactly. So, according to this, Welles and Hearst actually never met. He never visited San Simeon, although Jason points out that maybe he visited but was removed from the guest list. But the whole scene about how he met the... he went to Spain with his father and he met the great bullfighter, whatever. Turns out that great bullfighter was younger than Orson Welles anyway, so that really never could have happened. But it's a nice piece of theater in this movie to say why he picked Hearst.
In this movie, when he's talking to Mank, he pretty much says that any story about his father is bullshit.
Yeah, well, yeah, maybe. So, George Schaefer, the RKO president, ostensibly he wasn't fired because this isn't Kane. He was fired because a year later, his studio put out a bunch of movies, didn't make any money. So it wasn't just one movie that got him fired.
Did they not make any money because the Hearst newspapers buried them?
I don't know. Good question. But it seemed like it was more of a cumulative thing than just a one movie thing. But yeah, you're right. Maybe they took on RKO and buried everything. So... Marion Davis was ostensibly not the basis for Susan Alexander, although, again, the rest of the world would assume so. So I don't think that's really plausible. But she wasn't the mediocre singer. She was actually a pretty successful comedian, like a comic actress. before she and Hearst even met. But once she became Hearst's mistress, she didn't act as much anymore, I don't think. And then, of course, I think we had touched on this one talking about Citizen Kane. The whole War of the Worlds hysteria is a great piece of the Orson Welles legend, but it's was probably, again, it was probably a piece of journalistic hype more than an actuality. Like, it's always, you know, the radio show that scared the nation to death. Well, it scared some people for sure, but fake news. Anyway, RKO 281. Any other notes for anybody? I know we kubled it a little bit, but again, I think
a little bit
from the very beginning. I kind of said, well, this is kind of just an add-on.
Yeah.
To the Citizen Kane episode.
It's nearly just a supplement.
Yeah, we took a 20-minute Brexit side quest.
I still stand by my statement that this movie is way more enjoyable to watch than Citizen Kane.
Yeah, it is. It is because the gravity of what's happening isn't put upon you. This is a movie that you get to watch and enjoy, where Citizen Kane you get to watch, but there's so much going on and it is so intense, I think, that you can't just be passive with Citizen Kane. You have to actually be engaged, and that's a long ride.
Well, and I think this movie is more fun to watch, except that both movies make each other better. Like, I think after watching this movie, it gives you a little bit more appreciation of some of the Citizen Kane, like, shot angles and stuff when they ripped up the floor, and there's just the whole difficulty in making the movie. But I don't think you enjoy this movie as much if you haven't seen Citizen Kane.
That scene you mentioned is actually one of the specific scenes that has always stuck with me from this movie, is not being able to get the camera low enough to get the angle of the shot he wanted. So he actually, John Wick style, yes, opens up the floor.
Indeed.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great scene. I love that type of stuff. Also, we didn't mention that his director of photography, played by Davos from Game of Thrones.
Oh,
very young looking.
Yeah. Well, and it shows Wells obsessively watching movies in preparation for directing this movie. And, you know, again, it's the thing about Orson Welles in this time is, again, he's this boy genius. He kind of assumes he can pull anything off. And by force of will, he manages to do a lot of it.
Yeah.
He doesn't think that it's not possible. And only after this battle with Hearst was he finally put in his place by future movie executives who said, no, you can't have all this control. You can't have unlimited budgets. You can't have your every artistic whim just satisfied. So he gets to be the disgruntled genius. And a little bit sad in his own right. Yeah. I mean, again, it's hard to feel sorry for William Randolph Hearst, even when he loses his fortune, because he may lose his fortune, but he still has his castle. And he has to sell a lot of his stuff. And granted, stuff seems to be very important to him. But he still had plenty of stuff. He didn't go hungry. And, you know, Orson Welles still worked his whole life.
James Cromwell is so good in this movie. There's no way Hearst should be remotely sympathetic.
You're right. I don't know. I think this movie was acted and directed well.
It was.
Yeah.
It
was. Everybody great. gives good performances, so I enjoyed it. So thank you guys very much. Jason, what's your verdict?
This is an A movie, because I can watch it, I can rewatch it, and I enjoy it. It's never been slack. It moves. This movie definitely moves. The characters seem real, like, and it's a period piece, which I appreciate. But it's a good looking film. It's a little aged, but other than that, it's a perfectly fine film. And again, I think it's rewatchable easily. So
I think so too. So Drew, was it worth it?
It's definitely worth it. Watch this movie and then just tell people you watch Citizen Kane. It's fine. It's absolutely fine.
There you go. Perfect.
Your time will be much better spent.
So can you also listen to Orson Welles' Mercury Radio version of A Heart of Darkness and then just say you've read the Conrad novel?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because I found the Conrad novel impossible to read.
I wrote an AP English essay on that and never read it.
Excellent. Good for you.
I got a 5.
That's a good score?
Yes.
It's the top score?
Yes. Got me out of English in my freshman year of college.
Kelly would pay serious money. Well, she is paying serious money as a consequence of not taking AP English classes in high school. Brother Jay?
I would strongly recommend people go to YouTube and seek out the Orson Welles Paul Masson wine commercial.
Is it the actual commercial or is it a
both
the animation?
Oh no, it's the actual commercial with all the live recordings that they had to string together and overdub him.
Oh, that's funny.
Because okay, yes. he is clearly intoxicated before they ever start the ad.
So it's not the petulant frozen peas commercial or whatever?
Not quite that level. I love that frozen peas thing, by the way.
I just like the animation. Did you see it, Drew? Have you watched it on YouTube?
The animation?
Yeah.
No.
It's just very crude. Like, it's a still picture either of Orson Welles or a drawing of Orson Welles and the lips
move. It's like he's a Canadian in South Park.
Yeah, a little bit.
That old Conan O'Brien bit with Bill Clinton?
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. God, Conan O'Brien bits.
I love Conan O'Brien.
What a weirdo.
Yeah, but I find him hilarious.
Are you listening to his podcast?
I didn't know he had a podcast, so
oh,
no.
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? According to some press, he has actually started the podcast revolution. It's like, what?
How could he have started something?
I think Jimmy Pardo and Adam Carolla and Joe Rogan and Keith and the Girl and Jesse Thorne probably have a lot to say about the podcast. Ricky Gervais has a lot to say about the podcast revolution that Conan O'Brien.
Maybe Mark Maron,
yes, Bill Simmons. Mark Maron. Yep, absolutely. And countless business podcasts. Apparently there's a lot of business podcasts out there. Actually, if I can segue into a little bit of housekeeping, I only have a couple things. I do have a podcast recommendation. I'll start out with a little introduction. I have never been a big fan of either King Kong or Godzilla as characters. I mean, I recognize them as classic horror characters, and so I appreciate that part of it. But it just, like, Godzilla never spoke to me, and the guys in suits things never spoke to me. Maybe it was an age thing. I don't think
Godzilla speaks to anybody.
Well, and then, of course, King Kong. I mean, I get the whole classic love story, blah, 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 beast versus the inhumanity of man and the whatever. But I don't like the original King Kong. I don't like the original Godzilla. Raymond Burr is in the original Godzilla, I think. I do like King Kong or Kong Skull Island. I really like that movie because it's mm-hmm. fun.
Yep.
Which made me like the first of the MonsterVerse movies, which was Godzilla. But I haven't liked any other King Kong movies. So, and then I watched Shin Godzilla a year or so ago, maybe 2 years ago, and did not like it.
I just watched that this week.
I actually want to talk to you guys about it at some point, I think actually during, like, as an entire episode. But the first time I watched it as like a monster movie. And it's not a good monster movie because the monster starts out looking stupid. It has like paste on googly eyes. And as much fun as it is to see,
it looks like a mentally impaired dog.
It does. It's just dumb.
Aww.
And then later when the monster, and actually at the very end of Shin Godzilla, the monster is pretty fucking cool. But it doesn't. It's not until the very end where you get like an actual, like, what you think of as Godzilla as the monster. But when I gave it the low review on Netflix when I rented it 2 years ago, is because I think it fails as a monster movie. But I listened to a podcast called Godzilla versus Podcast Zero, which is a podcast where they talk about one Godzilla movie at a time for these two people who really love Godzilla. And they're funny, and so it's very interesting to listen to them. It's a great podcast. It really is. Even if you don't care about Godzilla movies, it's fun to watch or fun to listen to. They talked about Shin Godzilla, and they loved it. And I was trying – in fact, that's the one they consider like you consider, I guess, kind of maybe like your Star Wars movies. Like you consider the Star Wars movie that you saw when you were at that right age to be your favorite. And then you would recommend maybe a different Star Wars movie to somebody who's never seen Star Wars movies. Well, they recommend Shin Godzilla as like the one to introduce Godzilla to people with.
Oh, man, I don't know about that.
Well, but the thing is, again, I still think Shin Godzilla does not work as a monster movie, but Shin Godzilla is a fantastic bureaucracy movie.
Yes.
I love it. Now, I think I gave it 2 stars the first time I saw it, and it's a solid 4-star movie now to me because it's a movie about bureaucracy, and it's kind of funny, too.
It is an amazing black comedy about the failures of bureaucracy.
Yeah. So, Jason, I recommend that you watch it.
Okay.
Again, don't think of it so much as a monster movie. I think that'll just get in your way. But I don't want to. Otherwise, I don't want to.
Tell me what to think.
Yeah, you'll get it. And again, there's some really funny things.
If you have ever experienced any sort of ridiculous bureaucracy, you know
who I work for.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So that's why I thought of both of you guys, because we've had these conversations.
Yeah, I have some thoughts about it as it pertains to where I work that I can't share on the podcast. But
oh, me too. Yeah,
it's yeah.
So yeah, so Jason, if you would deign to see it at some point here, we should all three talk about it at some point. But the other thing is, I've been renting a lot of movies from the library again, and like the last set of movies I picked up were Annie Hall and Sid and Nancy.
Oh, wow,
it's a strange combination, but like to set up for our Bram Stoker's Dracula and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, I got those, and I got the Night Stalker, Night Strangler set of the TV movies, which are great. I love those. Kolchak is like... Darren McGavin's Kolchak is one of my favorite characters in television, even though the show's kind of goofy. And The Night Strangler, the second movie, takes place in the Seattle Underground. So, somebody to recommend it.
So take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here.
Take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here.
One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you wanna catch an episode. They talk movies, so they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the brother Sanderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away unless you're driving. Keep them open in that case. We got Eric, Drew, and Brother J, welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way.
Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way.